Get on the G&M Family Market phone line and welcome our first guest who's appeared on dozens of movies and television shows through the years, from Risky Business, Moonlighting, Revenge of the Nerds, to recent work like American Dad, New Girl, and Supernatural. He's got a terrific new book out chronicling his career called Revenge of the Nerd, or The Singular Adventures of the Man Who Would Be Booger. We're thrilled to welcome back to the program Curtis Armstrong. Curtis, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's great to be back.
I love the book so much. And look, it's a memoir, sure, of your career and your life. Is it a stretch for me to say it's also a bit of a love story with the highs and lows that go with it to your chosen profession?
You know, no one has ever actually commented on that. I think it's, yeah, in a way it is. It's not like, it isn't a memoir from someone who is embittered or exhausted. You know, there have been highs and there have certainly been lows, but it's still the thing that I love to do. I can't imagine ever not doing it. And I've had some amazing experiences. This was one of the things that happened not before I started writing the book, but I had gotten to a point, I think in the mid-90s somewhere, where I was in one of the low spots. I was working, but I wasn't feeling like I was going anywhere. It was just not happening. I was doing stuff that was, you know, I just felt bad about things. I didn't feel I was working up to my own potential, and I was working on a show with the actor Kevin Corrigan. He was a young guy, and he'd grown up watching the movies, and he'd ask me what I was doing, and I was telling him I was kind of depressed and feeling crappy about it, and I'm telling him about it, and he's just letting me vent, and then he said, you realize you have a career that many actors my age would kill for, right? And it was like a revelation that I had a career at all. I had sort of thought that I was just jumping from one job to the next, and some were good and some were terrible. It was a big, a light went on. And you know, suddenly I began to look at myself differently as a person who actually has a career.
You have embraced yourself as a nerd, and that began appropriately enough in your hometown, which we find out from the book, was the place where the term was coined, in a sense.
That's right, yeah. Well, it came actually from Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss had written an early book called If I Ran a Zoo. And one of the characters, one of the animals in the zoo, was a nerd. And that was where the actual word came from. But in Detroit, in 1950, which was, I think, a year after the book came out, people started to use the word, I think it came out of the music community, the jazz community in Detroit, that people started using the word nerd to describe someone who was square. And it never took off. I mean, it took a long time for it to take off. I think it was pretty much very much in that one sort of community that it was used as a slang expression. But then, you know, that by the time I was living in Detroit in 1967, 68, when I had become sort of a walking target for greasers, that was where it started to surface again.
Now, as a very young man, you were exposed to the arts and you fell in love with a lot of different things, including, and I love this part, as someone who once played Marcellus Washburn in an amateur production of The Music Man.
Did you really?
I did, yeah. And you fell in love with The Music Man, and, well, I love the story of you attempting to stage it in your basement, and while you didn't really get to play Harold Hill, you did at least get a quick test kiss with Mary and the Librarian.
Yes, her name was Yvette, and she was a little girl. I mean, we were all little. We were all eight or something. And I had all of the boys in the basement to listen to the music, and Yvette, who I had a crush on anyway, and she was my choice for Mary and the Librarian. But, of course, you know, these kids had no idea what I was talking about. And they, you know, she was beginning to get restless about it, and I wound up taking her into the bathroom in total innocence, just to get her away from the boys. to explain what the relationship was between Marion the librarian and Harold Hill, and that, you know, we would have this duet, and we would kiss. And she was looking at me very hesitantly, like she didn't know that this was in the contract. And I showed her, I demonstrated what the kiss would be like, and I leaned forward and kissed her, and she said no, and turned and walked out, and that was the end of my production. I lost my Marion the librarian.
I love the stories of your passions, because I share so many of them, having also once played Dr. Watson in a Sherlock Holmes production, and to say that you're a fan doesn't begin to tell the story of your love for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's work.
No, it was that was an early discovery. I was about 10, and it continues to this day. And I've been fortunate. I've written on the subject. I've written for several journals on the subject of Sherlock Holmes, and there's a section in the book actually about my love of Sherlock Holmes. And I've recently become inducted into the International Society, the Baker Street Irregulars, which is based in New York, which was the dream of my adolescence. I knew that it existed, but you had to be invited to join. It was a private club and all of that. And some years ago, I was invited to join. So I was every January, I'm in New York with a bunch of other Sherlockian devotees, and we have a good time.
We're talking with Curtis Armstrong. His book is entitled Revenge of the Nerd. Now, the last time you were on with us, we talked about our shared love of Harry Nilsson. And this time around, we're getting ready to do a special that involves another one of your loves, and that is the Beatles. And on this 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper, can you tell the story that you share in the book of sitting down somewhat reluctantly to watch that Ed Sullivan show in 1964?
Yeah, it wasn't somewhat reluctantly. I was really irritated because I always watched Disney, The Wonderful World of Disney, and I didn't interrupt that for anything. And my sister, who was 2 years younger, had already picked up on the Beatles thing. I had no idea, but she had picked it up, and she wanted to see the Beatles on Sullivan. And it was a big dispute, which, you know, I lost. So I wound up lying there very bitter and grudging to watch these characters who I had only seen once before in a picture in the newspaper of them arriving in New York, and said to my father on seeing it, "If there's one thing I can't stand, it's women who try to look like men." To my eternal shame, I mean, can you imagine? So I didn't know who they were, and I didn't care. I just didn't want to see it. And midway through the first song, there were no words for it. I mean, you could say now it's the moment when everything changed. It was the moment where everything changed, but it wasn't. I didn't think of it in those terms. I had almost a physical response to them. It changed at that moment and has never gone away. And by the way, speaking of the 50th anniversary of the Sgt. Pepper, that was, you know, of course, as usual, I go out and get those things when they come out. And I listened to it almost for a week, the box set. I just kept listening to it over and over and over and over again. And it felt weirdly like the first time I listened to it when it was released in 67. Where you're hearing something that you've never heard before. And the oddness of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, when you know it so well, the beautiful way in which they've remixed this is that you go through it, and every note, the fraction of a second before it gets to you, you know every note, and they're not quite the same. There's something different about them, but it's the same. I thought it was an astonishing accomplishment that Giles Martin did. Just an amazing thing.
Let's move along in your career.
Sorry to wait.
No, not at all. Well, we could talk Beatles all day. But let's talk about your move to New York. You become a stage actor, and also along the way, you fell in love and had perhaps one of the most unique proposals anyone has had.
Proposals. Wait a minute. Hang on.
A marriage proposal?
Oh, you mean my marriage proposal?
Yeah.
Oh, my first. So, yes, I had fallen in love with Cynthia Carle, who was an actress I was touring with in a play. And we had done, we were going eventually to like 77 cities over 2 years or something. And it was long. And we fell in love on the road. And then we were on a summer break back from the road before we started up in the fall again. And we didn't have any money. And we were sitting around her apartment and she suggested we play poker. And I didn't know how to play poker. So she taught me and we started playing, but we didn't have money for, you know, putting down bets or anything. And she said, you know, we should bet really. And I said, oh, all right, you know, maybe we could do this. I said, if, you know, we'll do one hand, and if you win, then we stay the way we are, living in separate apartments. We just continue the way we're doing it. And if I win, we'll get married. And she thought about that for a minute and said, okay. And we did our... we played our hand, and I thought I had lost. And she corrected me, and she said, "No, you see, actually, you won that. That was actually you won." And so we were married 10 days later.
On to the movies, Risky Business, the role of Miles that has become so iconic, and a terrific movie, both written and directed by Paul Brickman. It sounds like it was a wonderful experience, a great bonding by the members of the cast, except perhaps for the star, who was, is it safe to say, a unique person and maybe not what people would expect, young Tom Cruise.
Well, no. I mean, that's the thing about Tom is that, you know, I think that there are, you know, as he's gotten older, people have a lot of misconceptions about him, or conceptions for that matter. I don't really know, but I don't know him. But at the time, he was 19 years old, and you know, he was an extremely good-looking kid. He'd had 4 movies, I think, to his credit at that point, and very ambitious. Very driven, determined to get it was like he knew where he was going even then. He, you know, none of us would have suspected it. He was really good, extremely talented. His work ethic was good. All of that stuff. It was all the boxes were ticked. What you didn't see was that whatever it was he was focused on was stratospheric. And that, unlike most 19-year-olds, slightly goofy in some ways, maybe a little, you know, even insecure in some ways, he was looking at something that was, you know, beyond anything that any of us would ever accomplish. He did. During that, of course, he and Rebecca fell in love, and they wound up having an affair. He sort of tore through the local town. Tom did during the course of that movie. I mean, he was as any 19-year-old kid would who had the opportunity. I guess. I mean, I was 28 when we shot Risky Business, so I was like an old man on that set.
Revenge of the Nerds, a film that originally you didn't want to do. You certainly didn't want to play the part of Booger, and then they offered it, and of course you took it, and it became such a wonderful experience. I was impressed with the incredible level of collaboration that the actors had with the director on this.
Yeah. No, that was a unique experience. It was a studio movie. It wasn't like we were doing something independent. This was a studio, major studio movie. And the director and the writers and one of the producers, Peter McGregor Scott especially, these people just knew that the script was not up to par, that the roles of the nerds were not defined properly. And Jeff Canoe, the director, was insistent if he was going to direct it, it couldn't be a cartoon. He said, because he was actually a big fan of Risky Business, Jeff Canoe was. He said the reason that it worked is because it was so real. It was almost hyper-real, the way that the kids were drawn. He said, we can't do that, obviously, but what we can do is make them real characters. identifiable, because if you can relate to them, you're going to fall in love with them. It's going to make it, you know, a different movie if you can accomplish that. So for an entire week, all we did, cast, writers, director, all we did was work on the script and pitch ideas and jokes and character traits, you know, whatever. And the writers would be off writing every night, and they would come back with new stuff, and some of it worked and some of it didn't. We would reread, and, you know, all this stuff. It was a week's worth of rehearsal almost for Revenge of the Nerds, which, you know, you see the final film and you sort of look at it and think, well, it's one of those tossed off 80s, you know, gross out comedies or sex comedies. There was an amazing amount of work put into making it look like that. And that was what was, and then, you know, once we were filming, we were all so comfortable in those roles because of this, that we could improvise on the set and it would just go. Like, yeah. Brian Tochi and me, Takashi and Booger's scenes were all improvised. So, you know, and improvised there, you know, while they're setting practice.
You also fell
so
back on
quite an experience.
You fell back on your stage training and created a backstory for Dudley Dawson. And
when you got to
the end of it, you realized that that backstory was your story, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't realize it then. I realized it when I found the journal a few years ago. I came across the journal and was looking, and I found the biography I'd written for Booger, which is an old acting school trick, you know, to understand who your character is. And I'm reading it and realizing I was so proud of having created this biography, and now I realize, in fact, it was really just me. Booger was just a version of me.
I have to ask you about Moonlighting, that I love. The character of Herbert Viola was so wonderful, and this ensemble that did such amazing work, even more impressive when I read in the book about how all the stories that we heard about Moonlighting only scratched the surface of how dysfunctional that set was.
Well, it was pretty widely reported at the time, actually. I mean, you know, it was in the rags, you know, the Globe and things like that. But yeah, it was by the time I joined the show, you know, however they started out, it had deteriorated quite a bit. And then by the time I joined it, and I was there mainly to give Ms. DePesto, Elise Beasley, the receptionist, someone to play with, because, you know, apart from the dysfunction in the relationship, it's hard to imagine two actors carrying the weight of that dialogue for that long, shooting 10 months out of the year, and the scripts changed every day. Every day at 4 o'clock in the morning, we would get pages delivered to the house. That's going to wipe out anybody. You know, the stamina, the emotional stamina, the physical stamina that went into those two people doing what they were doing was extraordinary. So that was part of it as well. I think it was just they chemically did not work when they, you know, when they were together. There was a chemical reaction. The other part of it, though, being that kind of prickly relationship can actually create a spark, which can be widely misinterpreted by the fans, you know, as being, you know, affection or sexual attraction or whatever it is. In fact, it's, you know, two people who really don't even want to be in the same room together. But that's an old Hollywood story.
Your work in recent years at New Girl, certainly American Dad and your long association with that, and then The Scribe of God, Metatron, in Supernatural. Yeah. Is this some of the most fun work that you've done in your career?
It really is. I mean, there was a period there where, in addition to New Girl and Supernatural, which were two jobs I actually got the same day, which still I find incredible that I got two jobs like that in one day. They were obviously wildly different skill sets. And at the same time that's happening, I'm doing American Dad. And at the same time that's happening, Bobby Carradine and I created King of the Nerds, which was a comedy reality show about nerds. So, you know, that is all happening at the same time. And doing other work as well. So in a lot of ways, the last few years have been some of the most productive of of my entire career, which at 63 is not what you expect.
You also saved your perhaps favorite, not perhaps, your favorite role for the last 23 years or so, that of husband and father.
That's correct, yes. When Elaine and I married, we had one child, Lily, my daughter, and she is a total nerd. I mean, it's just marvelous that she took that on. She's actually a much more scholarly bent than I. It's a very happy ending as far as the personal life goes.
And I think a wonderful lesson at the end of the book, and as a proud nerd, I certainly subscribe to this. The fact that you figured out through the years, and we're seeing it in a lot of places now, that you don't have to. You're no longer required to give up the passions of youth.
No, I'm a firm believer in that. I believe that keeping those things, in my case, what it is, you know, it's, you know, it could be Sherlock Holmes, it could be, you know, the Beatles, it could be Twilight Zone, it could be Washington Irving, it could be any of the interests that I have that go back a long way. You keep those because those are things that feed you. I mean, as long as you still love them, why on earth would you give them up just because you've gotten older? It doesn't make sense. And what you wind up doing as a result is you keep feeding yourself with enthusiasm and joy, and it can come in any form. I mean, whatever the interests are now, which are different than they were when I was. It's not just comic books anymore. Now it's cosplay and all these other elements of nerd culture, which we didn't even have. And if you have it and you nurture it, It makes your life better. I totally believe it makes your life better.
Revenge of the Nerd, or The Singular Adventures of the Man Who Would Be Booger, available everywhere books are sold. Curtis Armstrong, it's a delightful read. I love your work, and it's wonderful. Thanks so much for coming back on the show with us, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much, Rich. It was really great talking to you again. Thank you.